when we look at that, the sequence of the rituals, we see the fuller meaning of that whole of the whole sacrificial system. That it's about more than simply forgiveness of sins. It's also about transformation and reconciliation with God so that we can enjoy the communion and fellowship that God originally intended us to enjoy prior to sin. So with that in mind, last week we began looking at the six steps in the sacrificial system. We saw the first one was you bring the animal to the priest, and the priest inspects it. He has to make sure that it is without blemish. And I remind you that word without blemish means blameless, okay? That animal that is without blemish is supposed to represent that, the blameless life, that the worshiper should endeavor to live. Once that animal is past inspection, then there's the hand leading rite. You place it, and you actually push down on the animal. And that is, I'm arguing more of an ordination or an appointment of that animal as a representative. It's not a transferal of sin. Where we are specifically told that is in regard to the scapegoat, which is not sent into God's presence. But this animal is going to be sent into God's presence, and it wouldn't be able to enter into God's presence unless it were still without blemish or blameless, so to speak. After that has happened now, the animal is appointed as a representative, then you slaughter the animal, okay? Now so we have the presentation, the hand leaning, and then the slaughtering of the animal, okay? Now, we still got three more steps to go. That animal has died in the place of the worshiper, but there's so much more. And that's why, why I'm saying that the sacrificial system goes far beyond simply the animal dying instead of the worshiper. All right. With that in mind, we pick up now where we left off last week with letter E, which is the fourth step, which is the blood manipulation rite. It's at this point that the priest especially takes over. To this point, all the priest has done is inspect the animal. Okay? The worshipers brought the animal. The worshipers laid hands on the animal. The worshiper has killed the animal. Now the priest takes over. And he collects the blood from the dead animal. And the significance of that is the life is in the blood. Okay? Leviticus 17:11 says, "For the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it to you upon the altar to make atonement for your souls. For it is the blood that makes atonement for the soul." All right? The blood represents the soul or the life of the animal. So the soul of the worshiper identified with the animal conveys the idea of offering up one's blameless life to God. It's very important, therefore, that God sees the blood. All right? It's not enough to just kill the animal. We have to think here about the Passover. You recall, you take the Passover lamb, you kill the lamb, you take the blood of the lamb, and you put it on the doorpost of your house, and you eat the lamb. God sees the blood, he passes over those houses. If you didn't put the blood on the doorpost of your house, God didn't see the blood, your firstborn would die. So it was not enough to kill the lamb. It was not enough to eat the lamb. God had to see the blood. And so that blood then has to be manipulated depending upon the sacrifice. The blood serves as a purging element, or some have even called it a detergent. Because it purifies sacred objects from the pollution of the Israelite sin. It covers the sin in God's sight. Depending on the offering, different things are done with the blood. in most cases, with the ascension offering, remember what we, you know, what's usually translated whole burnt, we're calling it ascension, or the peace offering, blood is splashed on the sides of the altar. Okay?
This square box here in front.
Blood is splashed on the sides. In the case of the purification offering, blood is placed on the four horns of that altar, thus cleansing the sanctuary, so to speak, sort of in all directions. I've mentioned to you before, I think it's very significant that Jesus had his head pierced with thorns, his hands and his feet, so that in essence blood was placed on the four corners of the cross. Okay? Jacob Milgram, who was before his death probably the foremost scholar on Leviticus, said that the tabernacle was basically, it was a lot like Oscar Wilde's The Picture of Dorian Gray. You know, in Oscar Wilde's play, Dorian Gray has a picture up in his attic. And Dorian Gray doesn't age, but the picture ages. So if Dorian Gray goes and gets in a fight and he gets cut up and bruised up, he doesn't show it, but the picture up in the attic does. It takes that upon itself. And that's what's happening with the tabernacle, okay, for the person. If a priest sins, blood has to be taken inside the holy place and placed on the four horns of the altar of incense.
This little smaller square box right before the veil. See,
the worshiper can't go inside the holy place. The priest can. And so the priest's sin would defile that holy place. And so that's why blood for the priest has to be put on the altar of incense. If it's the high priest, then it might be sprinkled there on the veil. Okay? We'll talk more about this. What I want to point out for now, though, is that the unique thing of the purification offering is that blood is manipulated in a special way. The four horns of the altar out in the courtyard for an ordinary worshiper, on the altar of incense for a priest, maybe even on the veil in the case of a high priest. And the reason for this, again, is because God dwells with Israel now. Purification offerings were not offered before the tabernacle was built up, but before the tabernacle was built. You don't have to do that unless God is dwelling in your presence. If God dwells in your presence, then things have to be purified by blood. And again, the closer that is, you know, it makes a difference where the blood is going to be brought. Real quick, yeah. Let me think about that more, but I believe for everything done in that past year. Well, I don't know if we'll get into this or not, but after Judas Maccabeus, about 160s BC, after, you know, there was a time Antiochus Epiphanes defiled the tabernacle. And so the tabernacle was out of commission for 3 years. And, Judas Maccabeus cleansed the temple, and it was rededicated in what became known as the Feast of Hanukkah. Well, After that happened, Judas's family was awarded the high priesthood. Only problem was Judas's family wasn't part of the Judas's family wasn't part of the high priestly line. It was his family is part of the priestly line, but not a descendant of Zadok. Okay, you remember Aaron has a couple sons, and then these two get killed, and then Eleazar and Ithamar take their place, and then through Eleazar comes Abiathar, and then Zadok, and etc. Judas Maccabeus was not the descendant of Zadok, which meant that his family wasn't really qualified to offer up the sacrifice on the Day of Atonement. And I think that's what Jesus is talking about in Matthew 24, or Matthew 23, I guess it is, at the end of that, when he says, fill up then your father's iniquity. There is a building up of Israel's sin, because for about 200 years, that Day of Atonement wasn't being performed. And that blood, that fill up, you know, the guilt of your fathers, that cup was being filled up because the sins weren't being atoned for. That's a little aside. Let me just, here at the bottom of this first page, we know the goal of purification is offering, the goal of the purification offering is expiation for the sake of forgiveness, so that the Israelite may be able to proceed with the stages of sacrifice that lead the worshiper into the presence of God. Okay? So the blood manipulation purifies so that we can proceed with these other sacrifices. Will come first once the tabernacle, before you didn't have that, once the tabernacle set up, purification, then you get to stand, offer your gift, and have a meal. And that's the goal, is to have a meal. All right. Now we come to today's notes. So that's last week. All right. So we're at the basic rites of the sacrificial system continue. So there's four steps. Okay, the next step is the burning rite. Again, it wasn't enough to kill the animal. It's not even enough to present the blood before God. After the blood is manipulated, depending upon the offering, now the animal, part or whole of the animal, is burned up and turned to smoke on the altar. And the important thing I want to point out is that there's a particular word that is used here for this smoke that is related to the word for incense. Okay? So this the emphasis here is on a sweet smelling aroma, a pleasing aroma in God's sight. Or in God's nostrils, I guess we could say. Okay? It's the word, interestingly, is related to the word for Noah. Okay? Noah is Noach, and this is a Nehoach. All right? So you could call it a Noah aroma. Remember, God's pleased with Noah. The whole world's corrupt except for this one guy who finds favor in the eyes of the Lord. And the first time we hear of this, you know, soothing aroma is after the flood. It appeases God's wrath. And it's like Noah is sort of ascending, or, you know, maybe Noah smelled good. I don't know. I just want to point out that the emphasis here on this smoke is on the transformation of the animal. It's not on the animal's destruction. And I'll explain that in a second. All right. What we mean is that when the animal is turned into smoke, it rises. It ascends into God's presence. Now, God in this glory cloud is, you know, dwelling above the tabernacle. Imagine this this glory of God that is localized in the most holy place. But, you know, initially they see it coming up above the tabernacle. And theologians debate whether the Israelites continuously saw that after that initial filling of the most holy place, or whether simply the fire and smoke out on the altar in the courtyard was simply a visible representation of what was inside the most holy place. There's some debate over that, and I haven't read enough to know to try to make some decision. But the idea is clearly that the animal is transfigured now so that it might draw near to God, so that it might ascend into God's presence. Okay? And so that's the emphasis. And we need to see that prior, again, there's an unfolding of sacrifices in Scripture. And the ascension offering is very significant at many times in Israel's history. Right after the flood, that's what Noah offered, an ascension offering. Right after Abraham's near sacrifice of Isaac, he offered an ascension offering. After God judged the nation of Israel for David's sin and mustering the people after the time of war, there was an ascension offering. Okay? And it wasn't until we get to Mount Sinai that we have peace offerings, that somebody gets to eat in God's presence. And, of course, it's not till we get to the tabernacle that we have purifications. So the ascension offering holds sort of an important place in the sacrificial system. It's the first. It's the first one discussed in Leviticus. And that places a tremendous emphasis on the idea of ascension. And it's very important that we learn eventually to refer to that altar out there in the courtyard as the altar of ascension. Because that's literally what it is. It's not the altar of burnt offering. That doesn't translate to Hebrew. So any Israelite who, you know, saw this altar out here, they always refer to that as the altar of ascension. Okay? That's what it's about. It's about ascending into God's presence. It's about going up to God's holy mountain. Okay? Now, way down here, number 6 says, in summary, the altar existed primarily for Israel's ascent to God because the ascending smoke became a visible representation of humanity's return to God. And that was the purpose of the purification to begin with, so that now the worshiper can return to God. Okay, little excursus here. A lot of times it is believed that the reason the animal is burned up is because the animal is now being sent to hell. Okay? I know some of you have asked me about that, and I said, we'll get to that. The idea, you know, generally as we think of the sacrificial system, is the animal dies in the place of the worshiper. So, you know, its life is taken. Then it's placed on the altar, it's burned up, so it kind of goes to hell in our place. And that prefigures Jesus, he descended into hell. Okay? And what I'm arguing today is that that is not at all the case, because the word that's used for turning into smoke here, the fire, is a completely different word that is used in Scripture to refer to a destructive fire, a fire that just burns things up and consumes them. Okay? Right at the bottom of this page here, it says, while the fire destroys the animal, in this case, it is done in order to change it into something new. In particular, passing through the fire, the animal is purified, transformed, and glorified. In other words, the animal is burned and becomes part of the cloud that represents God's presence over the altar, thus showing that the worshiper is acceptable to God by means of the substitute. In other words, after the animal's death, that animal is being transfigured to the image of God. There's a doctrine that the church fathers used to talk about a lot. Calvin talked about, the reformers did, but it's kind of forgotten today. It's a doctrine known as theosis.
Sometimes called deification. We don't like that kind of language.
language. There's nothing, if we understand it properly, there's nothing to be offended by it. What that means is there's a sense in which when God saves us, he makes us again God-like. We were made in his image, right? Okay, but that image became marred. And so when God saves us, he renews us in that image. And as Peter says, we become partakers of the divine nature. Now, we never become omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent, any of those things. But there's a sense in which we become partakers of the divine nature. Church fathers used to call that doctrine theosis. Right? And I think that's what's happening. God dwells, you know, like in this cloud. And so we kind of get turned into a cloud. We become God-like in that sense. Okay? That's what I think is going on. Now, with that in mind, you turn over to the next page. When we realize this, this helps us understand other portions of Scripture. What I mean is this. Every Sunday in the Apostles' Creed, we say that Jesus was crucified, dead, buried. He descended into hell. If you've ever thought about that, though, how can it be Jesus descended into hell when he told the thief on the cross, "Today you will be with me in paradise"? How do we reconcile those things? Well, I'm going to suggest to you today, I'm going to ask you to hear me out, that Jesus did not descend into hell. That's a mistranslation. Jesus descended into Hades, which is different. Different words in Greek, Hades and Gehenna. Unfortunately, until more recent times, a lot of our old Bible translations took the word Sheol, Hades, Gehenna, and they translated hell every time. More modern translations doing a little bit better of getting that right. But there has been sort of a synonymous uses of these words. Okay, so let me explain what I mean. In the Old Testament, you oftentimes read about people when they die, they're said to go to Sheol. Sheol is the Hebrew word for the abode of the dead. Sometimes it's called the pit, it's called the abyss, etc. Whenever the Greek New Testament translates the Hebrew Old Testament, it uses the word Hades, which was the Greek word for the underworld, the abode of the dead. Okay? Very important to point out that in the Old Testament, everybody went to Sheol. The righteous and the wicked. We have examples. You can look those references up. Genesis 30, 37, 35, 1 Samuel 28, etc. The righteous talk about going down to Sheol. The wicked are said to go to Sheol. Sheol, what I'm saying, is the same thing as Hades. So Hebrew word Sheol, Greek word Hades. According to Jewish belief, Sheol slash Hades had two compartments. The dead who had lived a good life went to that part of Hades called paradise or Abraham's bosom. That was a place of bliss. The wicked went to a place of torment. And these two places were separated by a chasm of sorts. Now, if Jesus clearly seems to be building on this in the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. Note, Jesus says that the rich man went to Hades. He does not say he went to Gehenna. And in the parable, Jesus talks about how you can't cross this chasm. And yet there seems to be this ability to speak across from one place to the next. So imagine this. Let me draw this on the board.
Can't get
get across. One side's a place of bliss. The other side's a place of torment. Okay? What I believe happened to Jesus is that he went down into Sheol / Hades to the paradise side. Now, our word paradise comes from a Persian word. It just means garden. Okay? Imagine that. Okay? So he goes down to that side. And we have confirmation of this in Scripture because in Psalm 16, we have a Psalm of David. And it says, therefore my heart is glad. I'm at the last three verses. Last three verses. My heart is glad. My glory rejoices. My flesh also will rest in hope. For you will not leave my soul in Sheol, nor will you allow your Holy One to see corruption. Okay? Jesus is going to die. His soul is going to go to Sheol, but it's not going to remain there long enough for, you know, like, for the body to decay. Okay? Very important, on the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2, Peter quotes that psalm, and he translates that as Hades. And he basically says, okay, look, this ultimately can't be about David, because, look, we know where David's tomb is, and, you know, he's been in there for a long time. I'm just in Acts 2:29 following. Men and brethren, let me speak freely to you of the patriarch David, that he is both dead and buried, and his tomb is with us this day. Therefore, being a prophet, and knowing that God has sworn with an oath to him that of the fruit of the body, according to the flesh, he would raise up Christ to sit on his throne, he, foreseeing this, spoke concerning the resurrection of the Christ, that his soul was not left in Hades, nor did his flesh see corruption. Okay? Now, he's just quoted Psalm 16, and he says this. So what Peter is saying is that Christ descended into Hades, the abode of the dead. If we take that with what Jesus said to the thief on the cross, that means he goes down to the paradise side, to the Abraham's bosom. And, of course, this may be what is referred to in Ephesians 4, where Paul talks about how he, before he ascended, he first descended to take captivity, you know, captive and etc. And it may refer to what Peter's talking about when it speaks about how he preached to the spirits in prison. Now, what did he say? He's not, theologians, well, we can't say that there's like some post-mortem opportunity repentance. No, what Luther said is he was preaching until he was announcing, he was, this side, these over here, I don't know. That only Luther, would think of something like that. Okay? But this would explain how there is a descent, what the Apostles' Creed is talking about, going down into Hades, not Gehenna, and then therefore correspond to what Jesus says to the thief on the cross. Yes, sir. There might be something analogous to what Jesus suffered and how that happened before he left. Yeah.
Do we know where David's tomb is now? If we knew where it was in the first century, we don't know where it
is. I think those Romans ransacked everything. Yeah. All right, let me mention, I'll just mention in passing, there's another word that comes up, Peter uses. When he talks about angels who sinned and are kept in prison awaiting the day of judgment, there's the word Tartarus. And according to Greek mythology, Tartarus was the lowest point. All right? Now, it's interesting to hear some commentators, when it comes to, they're scratch their head because Peter seems to be using Greek mythology as a way to talk about where these angels went. But if we remember that the Greeks were part of those 70 nations in Genesis 10, there was a time they knew the truth about the underworld and all that sort of stuff, about the abode of the dead. And so perhaps some of the Greek thought about the abode of the dead was derived from a collective memory of when they, you know, when they were at the Tower of Babel, when their families got off the boat, etc. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, I think purgatory, again, I don't find no basis for that. Purgatory, some post-mortem place where you pay for your sin before you can ascend into God's presence. Some people will appeal to the Peter passage, to where he preached to the spirits in prison as support of that. But I don't think you can do that. That seems to be derived more from the Apocrypha than from Scripture. I don't think so. But I do think that may explain why we chose to use hell to translate Sheol, Hades, Gehenna. Because of all this other belief about places could go, I think some in the Reformed tradition, somehow we got off and we just started translating all three words as hell. The Lutherans didn't. We did. Todd? Synonymous? Yes. I am. And I want to separate Sheol and Hades. I'm using synonymous, Hebrew and Greek. I'm wanting to separate that from Gehenna, which is the word we should translate hell. Okay? Now, let me just read here, number 5 here at the bottom. The word hell is an old English word that is more probably used to translate the word Greek, translate the Greek Gehenna, which is to be distinguished from Sheol and Hades as the final destination of the damned. Gehenna appears to derive from the Valley of Ben-Hinnom, which in the Old Testament was the place where Moloch was worshipped, and where the Israelites caused their sin to pass through the fire. Because of its awful history, the name was applied to the place of final judgment. Now, there's a sense what this means, and Calvin says this. Gehenna was a place on earth. That's not obviously where people are going to go when they die, but somehow it is metaphorically represents this place of final torment. Okay? So number 6, in light of the above, it should be clear that our Western versions of the Apostles' Creed improperly translate the actual Greek text of the Creed. The Greek text of the Creed says Hades, but the West has unfortunately rendered it as hell. Okay? In other words, if you recall, the church split in the 11th century. The Western church became the Roman Catholic Church, and then there was the Eastern Orthodox Church. In the East, Greek was the language of the Byzantium Empire, etc. The West adopted Latin. So the Latin Vulgate became the Bible of the West, fourth century. In the Greek-speaking East, whenever they say the Apostles' Creed is he descended into Hades. Unfortunately, in like I said, in the West, we tended to take Sheol, Hades, and Gehenna and translate them all as hell. So, in the East, they say he just, you know, crucified, dead, buried, he descended into Hades. And this is how they take it. In fact, in the Orthodox tradition, and I thought it might be interesting, I got a lot of problems with Orthodoxy, but I think this is something they get right. Their Easter is coming up in 2 weeks, and I've thought life's probably too busy. But, you know, they make a big deal about Holy Week, which I think we could do a better job of. But they not only they celebrate Good Friday, which is a real somber occasion, but they celebrate Holy Saturday, which is not somber. On Holy Saturday, okay, so on Friday night, you know, the priest is dressed in black and it's real somber. But on Holy Saturday, everybody comes there. He's dressed in white. The bells are ringing. He's taking flower petals and he's, you know, tossing them on people and all this kind of stuff. Because Jesus is down in paradise. And he's feasting with all these, you know, old covenant saints, etc. Or, you know, he's partying with them or whatever. So there's the idea. So where did Jesus go during this time? Okay. Well, let me say this now to get to Aaron's question. How is it that Jesus, you know, suffers the penalty of our sin? You know, the hell part was him doing that. Some people have tried to make the Apostles' Creed work by saying Jesus to sit in the hell happened while he was on the cross. When he said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Okay? The problem is that doesn't really work with the creed because the creed says crucified, dead, buried, then he descended in hell. So the creed clearly seems to imply something happens after his burial. However, I do think there's a right sort of sense in which we might say if Jesus experienced a hell-like, if he underwent a hell-like experience, that it happened on the cross. And I say that because if you recall, when God tells Adam and Eve, the day you eat the fruit, you're going to die. That day they died covenantally. They're cast out of the garden. The physical death later followed that. Okay? So they were cast out of God's presence, and then they died physically a long time later. The effects of the fall start, you know, the decay process, leading ultimately to their physical death. Well, in the same sense, the Bible speaks about when we're reconciled to God, it's like we're made alive again. Okay? So there's like spiritual death, spiritual resurrection. Well, it might be that Christ underwent that sort of thing, went on the cross. He first undergoes this spiritual death of sorts when he cries out, my God, why have, in essence, the two of you forsaken me? And then he suffers the physical death when he dies, when he gives up the spirit and is buried. So I think if Christ experienced something of a hell-like encounter, it would probably be there. And then he undergoes the physical death. To my point, I'll get to you one second. It's number seven. Here's the point I'm working at. In summary, a study of what happened to Jesus after his sacrificial death reinforces the theology of the burning rite as referring to the purification, transformation, and glorification of the animal, rather than the notion that burning the animal represents it descending into hell or suffering eternal destruction on behalf of the worshiper. Okay? That's the point I really want to make. The animal's burned up, not because it's going to hell. It's being burned up because it's being transfigured. It's becoming a partaker of the divine nature. It's being remade in the image of God. It's ascending in God's presence. And that's the point of the work. So I think when we properly understand what happened to Jesus, we properly understand the sacrificial system, what happens there, it all really works well together. You can see how it's configured. That's it.
Could you, I don't want to take too long, but of course we need to practice music. What's the antecedent to it when Jesus says it is finished?
Say that again.
What's the antecedent of the pronoun it when Jesus says it is finished?
Oh. I don't know if I'm understanding what.
He's on the cross and just before he dies.
Mm-hmm.
He drinks the wine.
Yeah.
What is finished?
It's finished. Why came here?
Yeah, I'm guessing so. This is something that is interesting, and let me tie it into all this stuff. You know, I mentioned this briefly, Good Friday. We had this somber service, and then we went to the Carpenters and we drank wine and we celebrated. Okay? That's not too common in the Reformed tradition, and in the Lutheran tradition a little bit more. But Jim Jordan had recently written an article called A Paradise Party. And what he said is that when he said it is finished, that was it. It is very significant to point out that at the Last Supper, I've mentioned this to y'all many times, at the Last Supper, Jesus says, I will no longer drink of the fruit of the vine with you until I drink it anew in my Father's kingdom. Whenever the Israelites were going to war, they would take a Nazirite vow, which they would not drink from the fruit of the vine. And that's what you do when you're going to war. Jesus is getting ready to go to war, says, I'm not going to drink, the fruit of the vine anymore until I drink it anew with you in your Father's kingdom. After the war is over and you have peace, then you drink the wine. The first time Jesus is offered wine on the cross, he refuses it. It's only after he says, I thirst, and he drinks of the fruit of the vine from the cross and says, it is finished, which is a sign that he has conquered then. That's done. And so there's no more. It's right. There's no more suffering after that. That's what Jordan says, like in our Good Friday service, you want to do a somber service, that's fine. But after that last song, no, it needs to be something. You know, we did, I'm always throwing new things out at y'all, and I'm like, you know, whatever. So, okay, we're doing it now. When do I get a chance to talk about it? So we did, Were You There? Maybe next year we ought to do something real uplifting after that it is finished, and then go and have our paradise party.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that makes sense to me. I'm still processing. Still processing that, how we need to do that liturgy and all that. I do think we could learn something from the East in this regard. Let me say this. I'm not ready. What I do when I say the Apostles' Creed, I make a mental note. I'm not ready to come around and change it and answer that question to anybody that comes in here. Why does it say that he descended into Hades? Okay? What I do is kind of like when we do the Ten Commandments. And we say, 6 days you shall labor, the seventh, we rest. We all make a mental adjustment to the first day there, don't we? We know that's changed somewhat. And so, when I say that he descended into hell, I'm understanding, that what that actually means, he descended into Hades. I think it's just a bad translation. There's clearly two different words in the Greek that are used in the New Testament. Hades is the New Testament equivalent of the Old Testament Sheol. Every time Sheol is used in the Old Testament, where it's quoted in the New Testament, Hades is the word. Gehenna is something else. Yeah.
In Psalm 139, the psalmist, I can't remember his David or not, talks about, when I ascend into heaven, you are there. When I descend into hell, you are there. Where can I have your presence? I don't know about
there is a lot of debate about that. The best I've heard is that God is present there, but here's the difference. Okay, so God is this consuming fire. So when we behold this glory of God in heaven, this consuming fire is just purifying us. It's gold and silver. But it's God's fire, even in hell. But in that case, it's wood, hay, and stubble that's being burned. Now, David is using the word Sheol there in Psalm 139, obviously. But there's debate about that. So are we saying God, who's omnipresent? But there's also a sense in which, even though God's omnipresent, he has his special presence places, like in the tabernacle. Back there, you're cutting into Seth's time.
No, it's all right. I got it. So I'm just kind of spitballing here, but it seems like, if you separate the two sides, and you think of like what you're saying, the blood, and we turned into to ascend into God's presence. So the guys that are covered in the blood of Christ, it's a refining fire, so purify. Guys across the chasm, they're not covered in the blood of Christ. So that's just that
Yeah. Well, of course, this is the old covenant. Now we go to heaven. And so I want to make it clear that in the old covenant, it's like everybody went there. How did anybody go to God's presence until Christ had done his work, until that veil was torn too? And so I think the old covenant saints ascended afterwards with Christ. And as John 3 says, no one has gone into heaven, only he who has come down from heaven. So now there's a transformation that's taking place. She doesn't hate you. The book of Revelation says, going to be thrown, you know, Hades is going to be thrown in the lake of fire. This is kind of God's obsolete.
So then that's why Paul says that, can say that now that in your absence of the body,
present the Lord.
Going straight to heaven, real fast.
Do you have any idea how Job and the patriarchs got their knowledge of sacrifice to God?
It's clear God had to communicate something to them.
Noah knew the difference between clean and unclean animals on the ark. We have to assume that there was a lot of communication that God had made with people that we don't have. In Genesis 26, I think 4 or 5, something like that, God says, Abraham kept all my commandments, statutes, ordinances, and laws. So there had to have been a lot revealed to the patriarchs that we don't know about. You know, Joseph knows it's wrong to commit adultery before that's published it at Mount Sinai years later. So there was a lot they knew somehow that God had communicated.